It didn't mean that Umbrus, the Chazal, said that Umbrus, you see, Was it really a third drop that, or did the big magic all going to drop that? Third level pattern being down. So what Humphreys did was to put down a 20 courage of a shot to be elaborated on in courage of a bubble. That's why Humphreys can't take all the different ways the first up of the world to the Adex and Ethnas and the Thomas Roswell, etc. And he translates it in the way he does. We're not being literal. That means the courage to stop if you're not referring to Yadakan. It means a certain idea. You don't refer to Sakha's Rakhla. That's not the courage to stop. And that's why the Rabbanim are in a root. When you go through all of this, the Hebrew language, the words, are not always meant to be their absolute literal form. When you use Adrei HaShamayim, doesn't mean the Shemayim has a leg. But Hebrew is a metaphorical language. But even the shots of the words have to be used metaphorically. So what is it? What is essentially the most important part of the growth? Because that's what keeps the growth moving. Because Adrei HaShamayim is the center of the most important part of the growth. Adrei HaShamayim. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The Rambam says, because Hebrew is a language that shocks the word. He's not in the metaphor. So therefore, I'm not in the realm of remnant or drash or so. Those metaphors are on the level of shock itself. Now, that, however, take a look at the Rashbam. The Rashbam sometimes was not happy to go into the nine stories about that. The Rashbam is going to go. On the other hand, Rashbam said, it is the person going through the absolute literal translation of the word, even though the ultimate shot in the pulse is different. That's why people say, well, Rashbam was always a Chazal. Anyone who's familiar with everything that Rashbam wrote, he said that. Except he said, there's different levels even within shot. There's shot and what the pulse means, and then certain literal translations of the word. Now, the Gemara of Yavah, very important to learn the Rosh. Thank you, the Hajj, that's it. And that's it. Learn the Rosh, because the Chorah Torah, Kura, and Yisra Yosef, and then Kito, Kuch, and Dover, and that. While Torah is to be interpreted on the level of Shat, Rene, Rosh, and Dover, but Shat is always true. And you have to know what is Shat. Where I am Shat, I am the Shat of I am Shat, I am the Mom. But there's always a level of shot. Okay, with the exception of one parcel, that's the parcel for all your half parts, and the Seder, your promotion, of the Hamed. This. That is the only exception. And Chazal made a certainty on that parcel. But he said, this is not this. The parcel doesn't go according to the shot. That is what Chazal did. So that means, all other children in the closet may be remnants and have all sorts of levels of meaning that is also true. I read the final prophet once said that when the Jesus said it's using the dice, Kol Hashim Kodesh, which is Hashim Kodesh Kodesh, means Jesus. While Chazal there are talking about who that all other areas probably have four levels of shot and then they're driving stuff. However, Kirachim does not have a level of shot. It's only remnant driving stuff. Therefore, in the times of the Shonen, there were many Shonen who confronted a certain tendency of putting off certain types of equality. To take the Torah and serve it very metaphorically. Avraham Avinu wasn't really Avraham. Avraham Avinu is indigenous. Avraham Avinu is Tura, Kasher, all sorts of very fancy ideas. And Sardin Nayu, really, it wasn't a human being, Sardin Nayu. But one was Tura, one was Kamer, and one was this, and one was that, all sorts of fancy ideas. And the Rajpa, a number of these big things in their eyes or not. I brought the human being to accept their training. It would be too easy, everything they would do. But there was a physical human being walking on planet Earth, with two eyes, a nose, a mouth, two ears. His name was Abramovich. And he had a wife, same thing, a real human being. And they died and are buried in Maraz and Machpelah. These are very great human beings who represented certain concepts. That may be true. But it doesn't take away, there's a simple chat in the puzzle. There was a human being, a male by the name of Avraham Avinu. He walked around here in Eretz Yisrael. He lived for a while in Hebron, for a while in Be'er Sheva. Real human being. This chat is Remishbrachim's other thing. And people who want to say when they find themselves a little uncomfortable, well, to the Torah, that this really wasn't this, and this really, so everything is a metaphor. Shot. That's why anyone who decides that Gan Eden didn't exist, the Ramban writes, Chumash, Gan Eden is a real place on planet Earth. The fact that we don't happen to know where it's located. Okay, so some people feel that they understand the entire world. But anyone who has done any serious thinking about the world realizes you understand a very small part of any part of the world. So if we can't find Gan Eden, it doesn't mean it exists. It doesn't exist. It doesn't mean it has to be a metaphor that other Mauritians didn't exist and Chava didn't exist, etc. So, Ain Kol HaTorah Kula and Mishu Yotim with a Shuda Chuk Mizav HaZeh, there's one Pasuk in Chamisha Kum Shei Torah that doesn't go for any shot. The only one. Now, in understanding the Bria, and what's involved in the Bria, of course, people want to be show that they're scientifically advanced, get all sort of bent out of shape when they think that the world was created in 6 days and we are living in the year 5,765. 5,765 is clearly the time that Adam Arish, the first human being who was created in the capital of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who walked on a Gan Eden. That led man to pull the entire Masorah class. So, therefore, if anyone is bothered by all the dating of certain things in human beings, etc., our Masorah is very clear, unless Mandapoli, that today two real human beings, Adam and Chava, left a real place on planet Earth called Gan Eden, that was the end of the 6 day of Bria, was 5,765 years ago. Now, the question is, there seems to be, what about the Sheshes Yemei Breishis, number one? And what about all the fossils we have, etc.? That, in order to understand how all this fits in together, you have to understand what science is about, when science makes certain statements, and why science makes certain statements. And there's a certain very amateurish view of science. Science unfolds truth. Any scientist knows science makes no pretension that people understand what it's about, say anything about truth. What does science do? Science measures certain phenomena that exist in this world. On this, it tries to come up with certain rules that can predict what will happen in the next one. I take this safe and I let it go and it falls. Scientific observation isn't false. You do it 20 times, 20 different objects, they all fall. So then what does someone do? He said that, well, let's try to make a rule that will predict A, that everything's going to fall, and B, at what speed it's going to fall. That's when Newton came up with the law of gravity. Now, coming up with the law of gravity, what does that mean? You see a lot of phenomena, you take a rule, that's going to enable you to predict what's going to happen the next time. Now, that may be the way the world works, it may not be the way the world works. There may be
25, as long as you're going to invent rules, there may be 25 different rules that predict the same phenomenon. So how do you proceed? With which rule take? So there's a rule called Occam's Razor. O-C-C-A-M, approximately S, Occam's Razor. Occam was a medieval Christian philosopher monk. And the rule is that if you have 25 different explanations of a natural phenomenon, you take the simplest and you take that one that works, and then it stops working, you go to the next more complicated. Well, Occam's Razor. Why? Because you want a rule that you can work with. It's easy to work with a simple rule. And the whole purpose of this is developing rules that enable you to work with nature and to predict what will happen. That is the basis of all science. Because of the fact that even when we observe natural phenomena, we do not have an absolutely precise and exact way of measuring them, that is a rule called Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is that when you measure natural phenomena, the more precise you try to measure them, the more you macabre. And so there's a limit to how much you can measure. For instance, if you want to look at something, you're going to need light. But you're going to have to shine a light on the thing that you're looking at. Well, that may be ruin the thing you're trying to measure. So when you realize that the process of measuring things can sometimes interfere with what they really are, and you have to take that into account, and therefore you never have very precise measurements or understanding of physical phenomena, that's called Heisenberg's uncertainty. For instance, in the 18th century, there was an English scientist by the name of Newton. Now, Newton wrote all sorts of books on classical mechanics called Newtonian mechanics. And that existed for many years, until Einstein, at the beginning of the 20th century, came up with his theories. Doesn't mean Newton's wrong, because for most of the things that happen here on planet Earth, if you look at what happens, you want to know how to measure them, it doesn't make a difference whether you have Newton or Einstein. So therefore, for functioning on planet Earth under most circumstances, Newton's fine enough. According to the rules of Occam's Razor, that's very good. If you want to begin seeing how light flows around in the stars, it doesn't work. Okay, so when you do that, you use a different type of rules. So all you're doing is trying to get the rules that will help you describe things. And for that, already, you needed something a little more sophisticated. What was more sophisticated? Then you came up with Einstein. But that's what science does. Now, science doesn't move backwards. Science says we see the world the way it is. In order to predict certain things, we're going to make one major assumption. And that major assumption is the way things are today, the speed of light today, the speed of sound today, etc. That's going to be the speed of light and sound tomorrow. And we found out that to be a very practical tool. That the speed of light today is same as the same. Therefore, there's another major assumption. Therefore, if we want to go backwards in time, whatever rules exist today, those rules have been existing back in time forever and ever and ever and ever. Why? You have no reason to say otherwise. It's the only way we can deal with the world. We can't deal with the world in any other way. Now that is a major assumption, even though we know that assumption not to be true. For instance, we recently had an earthquake that created a tsunami. Anyone who read this, the length of the day was changed. That how the Earth spins around its axis by a certain very minor amount. Anyone who would have jumped up said, oh, really? So that means there may have been other natural disasters in the past that also changed the length of the day. But science can't deal with that. Science has its rules, and science is not interested in truth. Science is interested in being able to predict certain phenomena and work with certain assumptions, and can only work with those assumptions and not take anything else into account. Therefore, the standard way of dating things with carbon dating assumes that a normal stable carbon atom is C12. There's every carbon, that's every life, every living organism is built around carbon molecule. Organic molecules are all carbon molecule. There is a certain percentage of carbon that is slightly radioactive with the decomposition, that's called carbon-14. And if you measure the decomposition of the carbon-14, you can move back in time and say, when did this thing die? That is how dating is done. On one basic, major, massive, unproved assumption. That carbon will decompose today, at the same rate it decomposed yesterday, as it decomposed last year, 10 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago. No one is around today who is around 10,000 years ago to say how carbon decomposed 10,000 years ago. Nor have people been doing this for 1,000 years, say, well, it's been doing that way for 1,000 years. They've been doing it for 50, 60. And so that's number one major assumption. When we confront the Bria, there's a pasuk that we're all very familiar with. You say it, Vayuchu Hashemayim Yehoared V'chol Ra'ah. Now, what does that say? The Ramban says the pshat in the pasuk, and he goes through many mekoros to this, is as follows. We have the scientific assumption that the world runs according to scientific law on a regular basis is really a puzzle. Say it every day. Chok notan v'lo yam. First broken the chok, that's not to be violated. That is, there is the law of nature that something, that when I let something go, it'll fall down at an acceleration of 32 feet per second per second. That's the way the world is. If that's the law of nature, that's not going to be violated. It could be that this changes very gradually so we can't measure it over hundreds of years. So if we see over the period of time that it changes, we'll have to change what the law is. But whatever the laws are, that the pasuk says, Chosnos and Lo Yavar, because it's broken, set up the world to run according to scientific law. Chosnos and Lo Yavar. However, says the Ramban, there are two systems of laws of nature. That means, 6 days, there was one or many systems of natural law that were necessary for an emerging world. But then at the end of the 6th day, when Vayir Vayivok Yom HaShishi, when this 6-day period completed, a brand new world emerged. That's a world that wasn't emerging, that was fixed. And there's a series of laws that, and that's all the laws we have today, that run the world, that keep the world in its fixed position. So when I wake up today, the world is the same as it was yesterday, and it's going to be the same thing tomorrow. But there are two periods of history with two series of laws. Number one series of laws from Vayichu Hashemayim V'yaretz Kol Tzvah. That is, those series of laws that are necessary to maintain a stable, steady world that doesn't change. Number one. Number two. There is a series of laws totally different that were necessary for this emerging world on those 6 days, with which HaKadosh Baruch Hu used to create the world. That's a totally separate system. Number one. So, if anyone wants to go back in time and say, well, there's a decomposition rate of carbon, and we move back into Sheish Yimei Breishis and beyond, and therefore go 10,000 years, wait a second. When you get to Sheish Yimei Breishis, the whole system just falls apart. You can't move into that period of time, because all the rules of nature just change. It's a totally different system. Number one. Number two, the Medrash, the Pasuk in the Marble, Noah comes out of the marble. Now goes Baruch and tells, "Oh, call you may are Zera, Vakosir, Vakor, Vachom, Vakayas, Vachor, Vayom, Vilaiva, Logis, Bos." So it says, Bobitim Alolu, says Rashi. Logis, Bos, the Machlau, Sheshotsu, Kodimos, Hamabu. So Shimsha, Mazolus, Vanika, Vayom, Vilaiva. The marble was not just a massive flood. The marble, Lachol, Vachos, according to Rashi, represented a time when all the movement of the planets and the entire natural world ceased to exist in the form it is today. There wasn't a sunrise, there wasn't a sunset, there wasn't seasons, there wasn't... All the planetary motions went totally askew. That was the marble. More than that, the message that said, not only in the planetary motion, the year of the marble, there were two worlds. There was inside the table, where all the laws of nature continued. It was outside of the table. It was absolute chaos. There were no laws. The laws of nature, as we know them today, simply exist. And the machlok is in the message, when we say that we are now in the year 5,765. What do we do with the year of the marble? Some say, doesn't count. It's a year when everything went absolutely haywire. It's a year not a regular natural law, so that doesn't exist. And the other mandor says, but inside the table, all the rules of nature continue to exist, so therefore we count. Now, if this is true, as Walter stated, that means any time you date back and you hit the marble, your whole dating system falls apart. Because what does the dating system say? That the laws of nature today are the same word yesterday, the same as the day before, the same as the day before. But then you hit a point where we say, well, everything just went totally hefka for whatever period of time. So when hefka, you just can't move past that system. You know, we don't have recorded history what the decomposition of carbon was during that year. And therefore everything just goes totally berserk. So there are two places that the whole system goes berserk. Namely, in the period of the marble, A, and in the period of Sheshi Mebresh. So that's why someone who gets very impressed by dating things with the decomposition of carbon, you have to understand he's making two major non-scientific assumptions. A, there was no marble. B, we're not chasing your vibration. Now, it was very hard to say there was no marble. As you would expect, there was a marble. We shouldn't be the only ones with the Masorah of a marble. Every ancient people should have a Masorah of a marble, which is point of fact true. There is not one ancient culture that does not have a story of a marble. So there are two ways you can react to that and say, so therefore, nothing a marble. Or you say something very unusual. There must be something in the mind of human beings that will always come up with marble stories. Now, which some people do, some people in their desire not to believe will come up with the weirdest and strangest thing. I find it a little weird that say, that something in the human mind has to come up with marble stories. Okay, there is a marble. The marble, and that seems beyond really an incontrovertible fact of history. So then, why don't scientists take into account everything, how the world just went askew? It's nothing else by all the water and all the pressure and everything and all the decompositions that went. A scientist cannot deal with a singular event. A scientist can only deal with regularity. And so therefore, all his assumptions are based on regularity, even though we know the Lachalapach was one period of time that there was no regularity. And it's very hard even for a scientist to deny, but he has no way of dealing with it. Now, we live at a period of time when different than when I grew up. When I grew up, the standard fear was the world was fabric, and it was proven, and it was this. That's the career that began with the Greek philosophy. If you believed in creation, you were our first moments, you were a primitive, you... Okay. Then sometimes in the mid-60s, they came up with a theory, and which is totally accepted in the world today, of a first moment called the Big Bang. Why? What forced everyone to come up with this idea of the Big Bang? Well, it was noticed that the entire universe is expanding. If you take a look at the distance between any two stars, that's increasing. So it's not, and let's say you have three stars, so this and this, this and this, it's not that this is moving away and getting closer, everything's moving away. The universe is totally expanding. So that means if the universe is bigger today than it was yesterday, it means it was bigger yesterday than the day before. And if you go back in time infinitely, you have to keep going back and back and back. But you can't keep going infinitely back and back. So you have to, you know, if time goes back infinitely, so when it becomes infinitely small, it gets smaller and smaller. And it's at the same rate. So so when that first came out in the middle 60s, so he came up with the idea, okay, that's very difficult to accept, because then you have to assume that the first moment is a Bria, there's a Bore, and people do not want to accept. It's a difficult thing for people to accept. Does it mean that there's a problem in their fear? And people will hold on to their fear to the most irrational degree. So then they came up with the idea of the oscillating universe. The universe goes back and forth like that. I know it, I'm sorry to oscillate, but if you have to come up with a theory to justify your fear, you're going to come up with a theory to justify your fear. Then along came Stephen Hawking, and he proved, no, we can't oscillate. The equation describes the movement of the universe and the expansion of the universe, has a singularity in it, and it means not continuous, and since that singularity, there must have been a first moment. So you imagine that, and we're just like Stephen Hawking. Okay, there's a Bore, comes up with a difference. This time the theory is that even though the physical universe doesn't go back and forth, there's plus and minus time. Time goes back and forth. So in order to get out of this entire thing, so what does he say? Okay, the world proceeds like a movie. Forward, backward, forward, backward. This morning for breakfast, I took a piece of bread and I put it in my mouth, and it disappeared. Another 100 million years when the movie goes the other way, I'll be back and this piece of bread will emerge from my mouth. That is how the movie goes back and forth. Now, you understand, Stephen Hawking is a brilliant man. Super brilliant man. But when you're confronted with the fact that somehow trying to upset the assault of fear, the human mind will be infinitely creative in order to adjust to this. Even to come up with, until Stephen Hawking came up with this idea, it was an idea that in all functions, that time is only a positive number. Time can be a negative number. You can go back and forth in time. Now, how does this all impact in the way we date things? Obviously, the dating process cannot precede Sheshem Abrashim. Number one. Number two. And here's a very deep scientific idea that also throws everything off. What is time? What time is time? That's not really, how long is a day? 24 hours. What is a day? Well, from 12 o'clock to 12 o'clock is a day. If you make, well, that's 24 hours. So what came first? That the day is 24 hours, you go from 12 o'clock to 12 o'clock. The famous story that someone used to be years ago, before we, in the ancient times, when I was growing up, that you Yeah? You press zero on the telephone, you got an operator. That's the operator, all sorts of questions. What time is it? What's this? Certainly if you're in a small town. Yeah, everything went through this operator. Story goes, I grew up in New England, so stories about New England mill town, that someone called the operator up every day and said, could you tell me exactly what time? And the operator said, well, it's exactly 10:37 and 45 seconds. Thank you very much. Went on for a long time. Then one day this person calls up the operator and says, operator, can you tell me exactly what time it is? So the operator says, well, you call every day. Why is it that you call? And she said, well, you see, I am in charge of this big mill in the center of town. And exactly at 12, you have to have the fire going off until the workers take off half an hour for lunch. You have to know exactly when the siren should go off. I need to know exactly what time it is. The operator said, that's very interesting. Because I set my watch every day by that siren. When you talk about time and the precision of time, have to be very, very careful. Very, very careful. That you're not doing the same thing. The operator set the watch by the siren. The siren set the watch by the operator. Yeah, this is the way, this is the way. But a lot that happens in the world happens. So you say, no, it really goes like this. Why did we make the decision that a day is 24 hours? Because we know from sunrise to sunset is 24 hours. But that's not really, as every one of us knows, that's not really true. Sunrise to sunrise is 24 hours. That's not true. Because there are certain times of the year they get longer, and certain times of the year they get shorter. Shkia today and Shkia tomorrow are not the same time. It's a slight difference. So it's not that Shkia to Shkia is 24 hours, or Nate to Nate is 24 hours. No, that's not true. It depends if you're summer, you're winter, etc. So what is it? So if you take the average of all the days of the year and you average them out, it's 24 hours. And that's where, and it's an average. Now, so that's really where the idea of 24 hours comes from, an hour and a second. But when scientists began measuring time, they realized what does time mean and how does motion exist. Now, everyone knows that it used to be people believed that the sun went around the earth. And then that was Copernicus. That was and then Galileo came and said, no, it doesn't work that way. The earth goes around the sun. And if you'll tell anybody today that the sun goes around the earth, will look at you some primitive, who knows what, Haredi anti-intellectual. The only people who still believe that the earth goes around the sun are people who never took any serious physical. Because, and here is when the so-called intellectual people who talk about science really don't have a clue what they're talking about. You know, they're the people who are the experts in science and are reading articles in Scientific American that they don't understand. But that's, motion means the change of position of two bodies. If this book is moving, it's moving, we got by what? We got by the table, we got by the floor. That means I take two objects, I view one as fixed, the other one is moving, legabe that. But that's just a decision a person makes, which is we define as stable, we define as moving. Now, it happens to be, and this was what Galileo discovered, 17th century, that if you want to make equations for the way the planets move, much easier type of equation to have the sun in the middle and all the planets go around it, because then it's the equation of an ellipse. And an ellipse is a very straightforward equation. If, on the other hand, you say, no, the Earth is stable and everything moves around, so then it's a much more complicated type of motion called an epicycle, which is the inverted, if those of you who probably never heard of it, the inverted equation of an ellipse, which anyone who was unfortunately had to take basic calculus, knows how to invert an equation. That's all it is. I remember one day, I told my father the firm of, you know, it's no real difference. Sun moves around the earth, the earth moves around the sun. I looked at me like, I don't know, how could such things possible? Does anyone who has any sophisticated knowledge of the of what motion means and then taken any advanced course in classical mechanics will tell you, well, that's just the way we understand motion nowadays. And a sophisticated understanding of motion means that's just a question of how the equations come out easier. And that goes back to what I told you in the beginning. That's called Occam's razor. Do the easiest way of dealing with it, because that's an easy way of dealing with it. Why deal with the world in terms of epicycles? You deal with the world in terms of ellipses. And now time. Today, when we measure time, a scientist measures time. So they say, what does that mean to measure time? So they have to find one thing, and the day is a very bad way of measuring time. Because the day isn't 24 hours, and the length of the day now changed as a result of the tsunami. So they begin with a certain unit of time. A certain unit of time that they now use is the oscillation of a certain atom and a certain molecule. That's the most stable thing in the universe today. Okay? So they measured how long that takes. And remember, this is really in many ways the story of the mill and the siren. They measured how long that takes, and they say, okay, that's our basic unit. And if a second is so many times this thing, and a minute is so many times this, and 24 hours, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's what time is and how you measure time. A scientist is never concerned with what time is. It's how you measure time. That's why, if right now, all natural processes in the world were increased by a factor of 10,000, don't know. If everything increased by 10,000, how would you even notice that it was happening? No way to react, no way to measure it, right? Now, so therefore, when we go back and say how old the universe is, that's why all this discussion is so borders on the theater of the absurd. I mean, it's semi-intelligent. I mean, it's people who took some sort of high school science book and looked at the Chumash and say, you know, doesn't really match the high school science book. Now, the Ramban writes, and this is a very fundamental machlokas in Kabbalah, between certain Mekubalim and other Mekubalim, and in other words, big machlokas in Kabbalah, and the Rambam writes, from his angle, and other things, well, so the Ramban says, do not think that the 6 days of creation are anything other than 6 times, 24 hours, 7, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Now, 6 days, real day. Now, what does the Ramban mean? Normally, what is a day? A day begins at Shkia and ends at Shkia. Ramban wasn't talking about a day beginning at Shkia and ending at Shkia, because until the 4th day, you didn't have normal planetary movement. And you didn't have normal planetary movement as we know it today. There was no regular sunrise and sunset. So the Ramban understood a very, and this is all the people now quoting Kabbalah, what, in the total absurdity of what's happening in the world today, the main sefer that's being used to show that Rabbi Eliyahu is an ignoramus is the Leshem. He happens to be, anyone who knows Mashu, is the author of the Leshem, as well as Rabbi Eliyahu's grandfather. The last name of the author of the Leshem happens to be Eliyahu. That's his grandfather. And don't you know, and the people who are screaming, this man is an ignoramus, didn't even realize it was his grandfather. Okay. But, see what the Ramban, there's a basic Havana in the Ramban, that this whole discussion becomes totally absurd. The Ramban says there's an understanding of time that's independent of what happens here in the physical world. There's a sort of clock out there somewhere in the Neverland, so independent of the physical Bria, that's measuring what's happening here in the Bria. Now, what's happening here in the Bria? Well, during those 6 days, what was ever happening here in the Bria had nothing, no connection to measuring anything that we have in the world today. It's a whole different system of laws. So you can't measure it by any of the rules that we have. The sort of measuring by the oscillation of this atom inside a certain molecule, that didn't exist at that time. Everything was emerging and developing. The measurement of time as we have it today did not exist in the same, in any way similar to what we have today. It's a whole different thing. And therefore, the machlokas in Kabbalah, there's 6 days, 6 periods of time, refers not to the clock that we're walking around with. It's a totally different machlokas, about totally different in yon, etc. So, yes, Torah says this.